sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear the second and final part of the speech given by Lance DeHaven Smith at the Toronto hearings on September 8, 2011. But first I want to tell you about an upcoming event. Barbara Honegger, who has done extensive research on what really happened at the Pentagon on September 11, 2001, we'll be speaking at the University of Hartford on Saturday, December 3rd at 7 p.m. It's an amazing presentation that you just don't want to miss. Barbara Honegger worked in the Reagan administration and wrote the book, The October Surprise. So again, the event will be on Saturday, December 3rd at 7 p.m. in the Auerbach Auditorium on the campus of the University of Hartford. And now let me give you a little bit of background on Lance DeHaven Smith before we hear the second and final part of his speech at the Toronto hearings. Lance DeHaven Smith is a professor at the Askew School of Public Administration and Policy at Florida State University. A former president of the Florida Political Science Association, he is the author, co-author, or editor of 15 books on topics ranging from religion and political philosophy to Florida government and politics. While at FSU, he has held a number of positions applying academic knowledge to problems of public policy. He served as Associate Director of the Florida Institute of Government, Director of the Askew School, Executive Director of the Citizens Commission on Cabinet Reform, Executive Director of the Local Government Commission II, Executive Director of the National Public Sector Gaming Study Commission. Mr. DeHaven's scholarship is nationally recognized. He's appeared on Good Morning America, The Today Show, NBC Nightly News with Tom Brokaw, CBS Nightly News with Dan Rather, The Jim Lehrer NewsHour, CNN, NPR, and other national TV and radio shows. Dr. DeHaven Smith was an infantry rifleman in the U.S. Army during the Vietnam era. He began his teaching career in 1981 as an assistant professor of political science at Florida Atlantic University. He joined Florida State University in 1994. He's had many recent publications and papers, two of which are Preventing State Crimes Against Democracy in 2009, which he wrote with Matthew T. Witt, and also When Political Crimes Are Inside Jobs, Detecting State Crimes Against Democracy in 2006. He was also identified by Florida Trend magazine as one of Florida's 100 most influential people and 5 most influential scientists in November of 2004. The speech was taped live, so there are some imperfections to the sound quality. I hope you'll find that his message vastly outweighs these imperfections. In the speech, he refers to SCADs on several occasions, and SCADs are State Crimes Against Democracy. So here he is, Lance DeHaven Smith, at the Toronto hearings.
I think one thing Americans don't do is just look at all of the suspicious events that we have. Just lay them on the table and look at them all at once, as opposed to one by one. That's half of the presidential elections. Now, I broke it down. This is a bar chart showing how I've rated these in terms of the degree of state involvement, the confirmation, my confidence in that. Most of them are highly confirmed. We've got tapes, confessions, memoirs. You know, the Gulf of Tonkin. You hear people say, well, that probably never happened. Well, if you look at the documentary, Fog of War, there's an interview with Robert McNamara, and he said, yeah, it never happened. What he doesn't say is he went to Congress and said it happened. But most of these are well confirmed. Some are mainly circumstantial, and I include 9/11 here. We don't have a confession yet. We don't have although the evidence of controlled demolition is pretty close to a smoking gun, but I'm counting that as not as strongly confirmed as some of these other things, where we had actual confessions and in some cases prosecutions. And then there's some that are speculation almost, that it's mainly circumstantial, but the circumstances are enough, that if it was an ordinary crime, you'd be exhuming the bodies or something. So most are well confirmed. They're hard to confirm. The perpetrators are experts. They know what to hide. If you look at Hunt, McCord, and Liddy, who were the Watergate burglars, these former FBI and CIA agents, attorneys, you sign a secrecy oath. Daniel Ellsberg has spoken at length about this, that you sign this oath that you cannot reveal a secret unless the person you're revealing it to has been explicitly approved to receive that specific information. So if you testify before Congress under oath and they ask you something, you can perjure yourself to avoid revealing the secret. These SCADs, they're industrial level operations. If you look at Watergate, for example, this wasn't a couple of burglars. They had two people in the hotel across the street watching. They had one person to pick the locks. They had one person to photograph the documents. They had one person to wiretap the phones. They had a whole crew of people. And it was a highly organized operation. So the difficulty in convicting people on this is often they don't know what their role is. They know what they did, but they don't know where it fits in the larger scheme of things. You obviously know that the investigations are conflicted. And then the problem of pardons. The way that works is you get the guy on the bottom and you threaten him with life imprisonment or whatever and say, but if you'll tell us who you were working for, we'll cut a deal with you. And you work your way up the chain of complicity. With high crimes, with SCADs, the president can pardon everybody. So they've got to keep the chain from going up to the president. The president resigns, you've lost your get out of jail free card. So it undermines the whole investigative process. If we look at the tactics, the modus operandi, as the criminologists call it, the most common are assassinations. I have six here listed. I didn't include the anthrax letter attacks that were mailed to Leahy and Daschle, because I counted them as a planned international conflict event, a false flag event. But if you had included them, there would have been eight assassinations that looked like some kind of state involvement. So that's the most common. Second is false flag operations, provocations, misconstrued intelligence, sabotage of peace talks. So that's a common approach. These false flag operations are not that common. 9/11 stands out as being such a big, visible event and also immediately followed by the anthrax letter attacks. So you have two right there, which I think is, frankly, is a signature. And I'm going to suggest at the end of my comments that it would be advisable for us to look more carefully at the anthrax letter attacks. Election tampering is a recent development, and the burglaries, which again is kind of a euphemism. But one thing I would note about this is if you look at their skills and tactics of military and intelligence professionals, and actually on some other work I've done, if you look at the development of them, you'll see that they tend to correspond with what we're doing in the international sphere. So we have a series of assassinations in the 60s. John Kennedy in 63, Malcolm X in 65, Martin Luther King in 68, Robert Kennedy in 68, Wallace in 72. We have this string of them. Well, at the same time, we were assassinating leaders internationally. My suspicion is that these tactics tend to migrate back in to our domestic affairs. But in any event, even regardless of the timing, you can see that the tactics show this imprimatur of intelligence and military skills. This chart looks at how well confirmed we have these SCADs and what MO they use. These are the highly confirmed, the medium and the low. This bar, the green is election tampering, the tan is manipulation of defendants or false flag operations, planned international events, burglaries. The main thing I want you to see is the ones where we have low confidence were assassinations. And the ones where they're low or medium were either assassinations or these false flag operations. So what it suggests to me is they're less likely to come out, particularly when they involve murder and treason. They're more frightening events for the people who participate in them. If you look at the motives in terms of what these SCADs do, who benefits, what are the consequences? most of them, almost two-thirds, affect war. They make war more likely to start or to continue or to escalate. Another, a little slightly less frequent, are ones that are just political opportunism. Rigged elections are common. So you have these two things constitute the bulk of what's going on. Manipulation for war and just pure old politics. Sometimes these things come together. You have a real witch's brew when they converge. So Watergate, for example, was connected to Vietnam, but it was connected to the 72 election. And you had a whole series of crimes. Oswald was just to conceal a crime. If you look at the assassination targets, what you notice there is that they're mainly presidents, presidential candidates, or U.S. senators, people who are directly connected to foreign policy. There are no justices of the Supreme Court. And these guys don't have security. One of our Supreme Court justices was well known for jogging through Washington, D.C., which itself is not particularly safe. But we have no justices of the Supreme Court assassinated, no House members until Gabriella Giffords. Although there was a House member who was killed at the Jim Jones thing in Africa. But if you just looked at, if you had an assassination once a year and you said who was going to get it out of the 546 top officials in the U.S., the people most likely to get it would be the House members. They constitute such a large majority of the public officials. And the odds of a president being assassinated would be very slim. The odds of two presidents being assassinated would be very slim. The odds of two presidents assassinated plus two presidential candidates become astronomically slim. The pattern doesn't look like lone gunmen out looking for victims. It looks like people who are consciously targeting officials. One other thing I'd point out, if you look at the presidents that have been assassinated where we think the state was involved or had some reason to think so, they had vice presidents who were very close to the military and intelligence establishment. LBJ was very closely aligned with the military, and George H.W. Bush had been the director of the CIA. So that's a peculiar pattern. I think sometimes they pick vice presidents to be assassination insurance. Remember Dan Quayle? Just a thought. Nixon said when Spiro Agnew, his vice president, was indicted, and he resigned, and they appointed Gerald Ford to be vice president. And it's on the tapes. Nixon said, uh-oh, I got trouble now. Before, they wouldn't have impeached me because they wouldn't want Spiro Agnew to be president. But now with Gerald Ford, my insurance is gone. If you look at the U.S. senators, the only time they've been attacked is when the Senate has evenly divided. You had a one-vote margin for the Democrats in 2001 that changed once Wellstone was out of the way. So that's a peculiar phenomenon, that the Senate would just be targeted when it's so closely divided. The SCAD trends, this just looks at by decade, and you've clearly got a rising trend. But there's another phenomenon going on. If you look at the 60s and the 2000s, you have a war agenda driving these SCADs. When the Cold War ended, we didn't see any SCADs. So you've got to think that these are deeply motivated by a military agenda. I also categorize the SCADs in terms of how many people had to be involved. And just to quickly say that most of the SCADs early on were pretty isolated. Under the Bush administration, they became far-flung. If you look at Watergate, Iran-Contra, and Iraqgate, and just look at the trajectory of criminality. Watergate was basically a maniac, Nixon, wanting to get reelected. And he did implicate some other people and get them to go along with him, but they did reluctantly participate in that. He hired the plumbers because the FBI would not wiretap the news media. So you have people saying they won't go along. But when you get to Iran-Contra, now you've got a part of the military and a big chunk of the CIA implicated. When you get to Iraqgate, now we're talking the Justice Department with the torture memos and the preemptive war memos. You're talking a big chunk of the military with its preemptive war and the CIA. So it's becoming much more pervasive. I think it's a frightening trend. Last thing I want to mention, some things about 9/11. It fits the SCAD pattern. I'm just listing some SCAD characteristics. Intersection of presidential politics and foreign policy. Obviously, the 2000 election had undercut the legitimacy of the Bush presidency, and that was turned around after 9/11. It furthered the war on terror. It involved military and intelligence skills with aviation and demolition. The crime scenes were investigated superficially with no check for explosives in the debris. Photographic evidence, you know, the Pentagon, all the closed circuit TV videos were confiscated and only one was released, which was of very poor quality. But there was also a set of photographs taken of 9/11, a helicopter flying above it. These photos did not come out until 2010. It took a Freedom of Information Act request through NIST to be able to get it, and they were really shocking because they showed so much dust and this patterning that looks like explosives. There's a name for pyroclastic pattern. Tendentious analysis. When they had a problem with the Kennedy assassination because they could only have 3 bullets fired in the amount of time that they had. And yet they knew one had missed, so they had to, with 2 shots, explain how Kennedy got it in the neck and the head, and John Connally got it in several places himself. So they came up with the magic bullet theory, that it ricocheted. Well, we have the magic buildings theory. It is this tendency to develop very tendentious analyses to deal with forensic evidence rather than look at the evidence and say, oh, geez, the implications of this are very significant. We need to follow it. Instead, it's like, oh, cut it short. The last 3 are the ones that I don't think we've looked at sufficiently. These events tend to have a lot of coincidences. They occur in clusters, and they involve some manipulation of our perceptions of the events. The coincidence of 9/11, I'm not going to go over this. I've already kind of recited some of them. There are many of them. But we have a science that calculates the odds of coincidences. It's called statistics. When you flip one head, one coin, you get ahead. There's nothing, no big deal about that. Flip it twice and get ahead. The odds of that are the odds of getting ahead once multiplied by the odds of getting it once again. 0.25. 3 heads, you multiply it again, so it's 0.5 cubed. When you get to 10 heads, you're looking at the odds of 1 in 1,000. I did a list of coincidences for 9/11, and I've come up with 50 coincidences, which make the odds of that 1 in 250,000,000,000. But again, the science really raises strong doubts about it. Oh, I did want to mention that we need a SCAD statistics. We need a field of SCAD statistics where people calculate the odds of these things. Steve Freeman did it after the 2004 election. He took the exit polls and compared it to the election returns in a bunch of states, and he found that you couldn't have had that in any kind of statistically probable way. That frequent deviation, particularly almost always benefiting Bush. But we need a whole field to develop around this. The anthrax letter attacks, there are a lot of holes in the Ivins case, but the main problem they've got is the silicone tin that looks like it weaponized or increased the dispersion ability of the anthrax. See, this stuff was going through mail sorters and coming out of the envelopes and spreading. But that doesn't work with normal anthrax. You got to do stuff to anthrax to get it to spread like that. And there are real questions about whether Ivins had the equipment or the knowledge to do that. But more importantly, I think, is the evidence of foreknowledge of the anthrax letter attacks. This is a report from the Washington Post, October 23. And what it reports is on the night of September the 11th, the White House Medical Office dispensed Cipro to Dick Cheney and others in the White House. Cipro is an antibiotic to fight anthrax infections. Now you might say, well, we were just doing that as a precaution. Yeah, but you didn't tell the Senate. You didn't tell the House. You didn't tell the American people. Why would you have given Cipro out in the White House and never told anybody else about it? George Bush's comment when this came out was, well, there's no question that the evildoers are continuing to try to harm America. And Barbara Honegger's got a good article on this, and it looks at the parallels between 9/11 and the anthrax and the people involved and the suspicion. But I think, see, what you have to think about is, just look at Watergate. You have this string of crimes committed. Well, they were all committed by the same people, the plumbers. So that's the way we should think of SCADs. When you see two or three of them occur together, it's the same guys. So if we start looking for who was at the scene, start connecting the dots. Last thing, this is a very speculative, but I wanted to bring it to your attention. And that is the question of whether the 9/11 label itself was planted. There's something peculiar about this label. Now, this would have been a top priority for people. If somebody inside the government arranged this, they would want it to be framed in a certain way and would have been thinking about this. So I don't think this is out of the range of possibility. If it's a planted meme, it may have the characteristics of the conspiracy theory meme, which was empty, it's vague, but it's emotionally charged. It's a conveyance of emotion. And it's foreign to the culture. If we look at 9/11, it's emotionally charged. It's connected to the emergency phone number 911. And that itself is very suspicious. Do you know what George Bush, after he testified to the 9/11 commission, he came out into the Rose Garden and spoke to the press, and he called it the 911 commission. And I think that's the connection, that if this was designed, was intended to do it, that it may have been time to be on that date to have that connection. 9/11 deviates from our naming conventions. We don't name holidays and events, frightening events, by the date. The only date I can think of that we have in America for a special date is July the 4th. But even that is Independence Day. Normally, we would name where the event happened, so Pearl Harbor, Three Mile Island, or how it was done. So the anthrax letter attacks, for example, if we use that way of naming, we would call 9/11 the hijacked airplane attacks. The problem with using 9/11 is it elevates the historical significance of the event. It's, as Matt said early on, that it is before 9/11 and it's after. It immediately conveys this way of thinking. And I'm not sure, I mean, I'm trying to figure out why America overreacted so amazingly to these attacks. Even if you accept the official account, it's like, are you really going to start a new Cold War? Because that's what it feels like over this. If you say 9/11 changed everything, that makes some sense. But if you said the skyscraper collapse of September 1 changed everything, I'm not so sure. The hijacked airplanes changed everything? No, not really. But the 9/11 meme, I think, well, it could be planted. That's my suggestion to you. I did track down the first instance where I could find where it was used. It was used in a headline and a story the next day, September 12th, and it draws attention to the connection between 9/11, the date, and the emergency phone line, and it says it was an aptly dated wake-up call. It's just odd that this came out so fast and had all these connections, and even the way, see, a lot of people were doing 9-11, or 9-11-01, or 9-11-2001. The very next day, 9/11, drawing attention to the emergency phone number. These are the kind of sciences I think we should try to expand. I've given you examples of them. I hope that you'll join with me in doing these, and I appreciate everybody letting me use all their material for my theorizing. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. David Smith. Panelists, we will take questions now. We'll start with Herbert Jenkins.
Your history of SCADs gives a new meaning to the term American exceptionalism. But I'd like to question you about the strength of the generalization from these 18 other SCADs to 9/11. I think that depends in part on whether you think that anyone who's considering this thinks there are characteristics of the 9/11 alleged government conspiracy which are not shared strongly by the other SCAD incidents. I think you pointed out some in passing, but I'm asking you to comment on the possibly unique characteristics.
That's a very good question. I do see 9/11 and the anthrax letter attacks as being unique and different but on the same trajectory of development. This is like an organism that is growing. It's becoming larger, it's becoming more sophisticated. If you think back about the Kennedy assassination, that was a remarkable event, but it was primitive in some ways. It was a high-powered rifle from a distance, and that left questions about who actually did it. And you see the assassination shift to handguns up close after that. So I think that there's a tendency for these things to evolve, and that when you get to 9/11, that it is, yes, it is on a much larger scale, it's much more sophisticated, assuming it's a state operation. It's a false flag event, which itself is relatively rare historically. So yeah, but I don't think it rules it out as a scan. I think it fits. My hypothesis would be, yeah, it's different, but it's different in an evolutionary advancing way.
I would accept that. I think that one of our purposes here is to keep people's minds open about the possibility of the government conspiracy. But I think that one of the obstacles for people entertaining that is the pervasiveness of the moral depravity or corruption of so many parts of our society, so many agencies, so many individuals, so many professionals.
Just a comment. I think that people could do this and feel good about themselves. I mean, as crazy as it sounds, look, they could look at it like there's going to be a nuclear bomb brought into the United States, left in New York or Chicago. We're talking millions of people killed. And we could have a small-scale event, relatively speaking, that could galvanize the public to take the actions that will be necessary to prevent that from happening in the future. So it's a trade-off of a small amount. I go back and look at the Kennedy assassination. They thought Kennedy was a traitor. They thought that he had blinked in the Cuban Missile Crisis and that he was selling out to the Soviets. And so we may look at these things, the state thinks differently. The state thinks, it thinks immorally, but in cost and benefits.
Professor Jenkins, thank you.
To see the video and hear the rest of the questions by the panelists, you can go to the website torontohearings.org or to YouTube and search for Lance DeHaven Smith and the Toronto Hearings. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.